Hogan, can you remember, was there a single person or a specific person who inspired you or led you to get involved in politics in the first place?
Can I remember? Like it was 5 centuries ago. It was 20 years ago, and I can remember, and that man's name was Mike Huckabee. I left journalism to work for Governor Huckabee when he was governor. I met Sarah Sanders when she was 19. So I've been hanging out with that family for a long time.
No kidding. Well, for me, a lot of people say that they were inspired to get involved in politics by Ronald Reagan. But for me, my own personal Ronald Reagan was I was a journalist as well. And I was covering this fella's term as governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And he inspired me to leave journalism and get involved in politics as well. So let's get right into it. It's Super Bowl week. Got a great guest. We could talk about politics and football because this is the Line Drive Podcast. And here he is, the great former governor and senator of the Commonwealth of Virginia, the one and only George Allen. Governor Allen, thank you so much for joining us. And I meant what I said. You inspired me to leave journalism and get involved in politics, and I have never looked back.
Well, Tim, I was so lucky to have you somehow recruited into our 2000 campaign for the U.S. Senate. And I always admired you. Even it's very few journalists you say you can admire. I always liked you because you were fair, which was so rare in journalism, and that still is the case. But Susan and I so admire your wit, your sarcasm, your smartness, you're quick on your feet, and just an all-around great person. And I really appreciated that. Was a great team we had in that 2000 campaign with Jay Timmons and Chris LaCivita, you. Good old Jason Meares was my aide de camp. He's now the outstanding Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, standing up for freedom. And that was a great election, a lot of fun. And most importantly, we won.
Yeah. I don't know if it taught me a good lesson or not. As I look back on that one, I can remember thinking to myself, heck, that was easy.
These are easy. Yeah.
You know? It wasn't that easy. We ended up being, I think, the only Republican who knocked off a Democrat that year.
It ended
up being just a one seat difference in that election. So it was a good win, and it's good to be with Hogan as well. I know Governor Huckabee. I remember after I was governor, Governor Huckabee became governor of Arkansas, and he had me come to an economic development conference that he had in Little Rock, and got to know Governor Huckabee back then. And he's another outstanding leader who like Tim Murtaugh. Just has a good sense of humor, a good way about him that makes people grin.
Absolutely. I agree. Wonderful man. And I was in journalism too, and covered Huckabee because our head political reporter at my station was covering the Susan McDougal trial because of Whitewater. So I got to go to the Capitol and cover Huckabee, and that's where I kind of fell in love with that whole situation. So yeah, so I guess you and Mike are to blame. I don't know if you get credit, but you're to blame to have me and Tim doing stuff like this now.
Yeah, no, we're glad. Yeah. You all would have risen to the top regardless of us. But even Susan and Janet went out jet skiing on the Arkansas River.
Yes.
In the midst of all of that stuff.
Of course. So.
That's right. Fantastic. Well, let me ask. I want to talk about the Super Bowl, and we could talk about the current events, politics of the day, and the god awful Biden administration, which I'm sure you have some opinions about some policies that old Joe from Wilmington has pursued. But I was talking about this with Hogan beforehand, and you've held a lot of offices. You were, member of the House of Delegates in Virginia, member of Congress, and then governor, and then a United States Senator. And, I remember you had some unflattering things to say about how business is conducted in the U.S. Senate, for example. But so I always just have called you governor because that's how I first knew you. You were governor of Virginia. So but should we call you senator? Which do you prefer? And which of your elected offices did you enjoy the most? I think I know the answer to that.
Yeah, one. Well, it was a great honor to be in the House of Delegates. I had Thomas Jefferson's seat in the House of Delegates.
Wow.
And that was really something. And I won that first election by 25 votes after a recount. I remember my father were waiting for the results to come in, and they finally came in, and I didn't lose these Democrat precincts as much as usual. So I won. And my father's reaction was, gosh, this is as great as beating Dallas. Now, for my father, that, you know, that's Valhalla. And I don't care about protocol, but you're supposed to take the highest office. And I think governor's higher than senator. Internationally, people like senator, but governor's a much better job. And to refresh your recollections on the things I'd get in trouble with, when people would ask me that question, Tim, how's the Senate compared to being governor? I'd say, I'd make more decisions in a morning as governor than you make all week in the Senate. And they don't mind not doing anything. They're very collegial, sure, friendly folks on both sides of the aisle, very knowledgeable, articulate. But I said, it moves at the pace of a wounded sea slug. I wanted quicker action. And it's only from talking to people who, you know, through the years, John Thune and so forth, who I helped get elected and, you know, served with, they say it's even worse now. So it's got to be frustrating for anybody who wants to serve to do something rather than just to be there warming a seat. But you can call me Jorge. I like my name in Spanish the best. So
that's fantastic. And aside from all of these elective offices that you've held and governor and senator at the top of that list, you had really a remarkable way to grow up. You mentioned your father and how you're winning that election is better than beating Dallas. And for those who don't know, your father, also named George Allen, was a longtime professional football coach, including coaching the Washington Redskins to the Super Bowl and losing to the undefeated Miami Dolphins in 1972 in that Super Bowl. And of course, those Dolphins are the only team to ever, still to this day, finish the season undefeated. So what a pedigree you have to come talk about football. And you also played quarterback at the University of Virginia as well. What was it like growing up in that kind of atmosphere, a huge, huge sports family?
Well, that's how I grew up, in the world of sports and football. And Tim and Hogan, you probably don't appreciate things when you look back on your life until in retrospect. And I've realized how lucky I was. My father was an assistant coach with the Bears. And he'd take me to training camp at St. Joseph's College in the middle of cornfields of Indiana, the L.A. Rams. We ran the L.A. Rams offense in our high school. It was the same terminology, the same plays that the L.A. Rams had, and other than the Dallas double screen that we had. And those players, the teams were very close. They were like family. My father would trade for a lot of guys from team to team. He'd bring in Richie Pettibone from the Bears to the Rams to the Redskins. Eddie Brown, who my father traded for me, he's a captain of safety from Tennessee. He was with Cleveland. My father traded for him with the Redskins, brought with him to the Rams, and they played on both his USFL teams. So these teams were very close, and what a great opportunity. And in fact, you mentioned Ronald Reagan. It's the reason I got involved in organized politics, was because when we moved out to California in 1966, when my father became head coach of the Rams, Ronald Reagan was running for governor, and he came to a practice, and he was there shoulder to shoulder with my father, asking him questions about the drills they were running and different players and strategies. And I thought, here's a politician who's at a practice. Normally the politicians want 50-yard line seats, but right. I said, here's a politician who knows what's important. Football. And Reagan, because he was at a practice again, and they looked like they could be brothers or cousins with their looks and their profile, and both Midwesterners. And Reagan won in 66. So I followed him through high school, what he was doing as governor. And then I go to UVA ultimately when my father went to the Redskins and we moved to Virginia. And Reagan, then Governor Reagan, asked me to head up Young Virginians for Reagan in 1976. And we were the rebels against President Ford. And that's what got me involved. And I remember I had told Ronald Reagan, I said, look, I like debating. I like arguing with people. I'm not in the college Republicans. I took no political science classes. But I liked him and said, what a great job. I'd like to tell folks what a great job you did as governor and great ideas for America's future. And he said, well, just keep doing that. And that's how I got involved. And ultimately, a lot of those old Reagan hands are the ones who inveigled or encouraged me to run for office. And so, you know, the point that I learned from all of this is, as governor especially, I wanted cabinet secretaries who knew more than I did about transportation or economic development, public safety. My father would always say, I don't want to have to spend time coaching the coaches. So I wanted our competitiveness cabinet to be stronger together with many people who had better, you know, more knowledge. They knew what I promised to do, truth in sentencing with the abolition of parole and high academic standards and accountability in schools and making sure the world knew that Virginia is open for business and lower taxes and prompt permitting, reasonable regulations, all those things. They knew we're going to keep our promises. But Kay James, for example, was the best person in the universe to be our Secretary of Health and Human Resources when we're putting in welfare reform, requiring able-bodied people to work rather than just be dependent on the government. And so we had just had I was very blessed to have a really good team, cabinet members, agency heads, and I had posters on the walls. There was a herd of wild horses running across the range, and it said under it, you either make dust or eat dust. And so we wanted to be leaders. And this,
right.
Let's see, you got it here. I've been doing here this, if not us, who, if not now, when. That was given to my father by Ronald Reagan. That's his quote. When my father was chairman of the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports, and when my father died, my mother said I should have it, and I had it on my mantle in the governor's office, Mr. Jefferson's Capitol, and also in the Senate office, which means, you know, the words of action. You get into office not just to be in office, but to do things, to make people safer, greater opportunities, make your state, make your country more competitive with lower taxes, reasonable regulations, affordable energy, skilled, capable people to work, and so forth. I could go on endlessly with it. That's the motivation to get things done that matter to real people in the real world.
Well, Governor, and that's all fascinating. It's such a great story and a great sentiment to share. You talked about getting things done. You also said that Reagan knew what was important, football. So because of your background, we got a big game coming up this weekend, okay? You obviously follow college because you went to UVA, but you're a Tennessee fan, is that right?
Correct.
But is there – before we talk – I don't even want to talk college right now, but it gets me all fired up. But from the pro standpoint, you know the game. What do you see? What are your matchups? Who do you think goes away and wins this Super Bowl? Tell us something we don't know about what we're about to see.
Well, I think everyone's got a lot of views. I'm one of those who actually cares about the football game rather than halftime shows.
Well, I know you're a big Taylor Swift fan, so we that's the only reason you're watching is to see Taylor Swift. We know that.
Now, the best halftime show, Jerry Jones did a great job getting Dolly Parton to get in a Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders uniform at halftime for the Thanksgiving Day game. I think it should be a really close game. Both teams have good defenses. So often in these big games, you know, defenses are absolutely essential. And also, even though the game has gotten so that it's easier to pass, and receivers can run free and clear, not with any of the bump and run that used to be there decades ago, I think that the team that can run the ball and stop the run will win. Now, as far as quarterbacks, Brock Purdy is a wonderful story. The last person drafted, Mr. Irrelevant. That's all great. That's what's great about sports, the meritocracy of sports, which we should aspire to in society. It doesn't matter where someone's from, their race, their religion, their ethnicity. You don't care if they went to Iowa State or they went to Tennessee Tech. It doesn't matter. Can you help the team win? And so Brock Purdy is an example of that meritocracy that people have to produce and perform on a level playing field. But Patrick Mahomes, to me, is just a fantastic. He's creative. He's dynamic. I think he's the most talented quarterback in the NFL. I think that the Chiefs on defense have to stop McCaffrey. Passing to him, running to him. Have Brock Purdy have to beat you. And I think they can do that. They have a good defense. In fact, the Chiefs' defense was outstanding this year, as was San Francisco's. I think that what the Chiefs ought to do is run the ball as obviously as best they can, but run it at Chase Young. Chase Young is shown to take plays off. Now, he may be embarrassed into producing play after play after play, but I'd run the ball at him. Some of these pass rushers like Chase Young like to rush the passers, so they run, you know, they get a quick start as a defensive end, and then you can run right behind them. So sure. I think it'll be a close game. I think the Chiefs will win. I'm rooting for the Chiefs. I like their owner's been the Hunt family have been good supporters. They live in the Highland Park, Dallas area. I like their coach, Coach Reed. How can you not like Coach Reed? Heck, Coach Reed, it still has tons of fans, as Tim knows, in the Philadelphia area.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't think the Eagles should have ever fired him. He's the winningest coach for two franchises now.
Yeah.
And soon,
well, they had a great one in Dick Vermeil too. So they've had some great coaches there, but they fired him, and it's been great for the Chiefs.
One quick thing. You said something the halftime show. You talked about Dolly Parton. I've never understood this. You remember when the Super Bowl was like in Minnesota, and then it was like in Detroit,
right?
And I thought, Minnesota, here is your chance to showcase a great halftime show with Minnesota native Prince. He's got a million songs. You could do a lot of collabs. In Detroit, I'm thinking Motown and all of the, even Eminem coming out and doing a rap, like all of these things. And they brought in like The Who and like The Stones, like great names, but not America. And then they go to California, and then they did California West Coast rap, which makes sense because it's unique to California. So I know it's a little rant I have. It blows my mind. You wouldn't want to showcase your state and what's cool about your state if you have it. And there you have a plethora of incredible musicians with historic songs, you know, well-loved, well-liked, and they went out of the country and brought in bands from Europe. It didn't make any sense to me. Sorry, I'm going off. That makes me mad.
Fine, I wouldn't have known any of those people you're talking about anyway. California, they should have the Beach Boys.
Yeah, or that, perfect. Anybody that's local, I just blow them up.
Let me bring up a picture. Let me show you a picture, Governor. If folks are watching on the mobile, who is this fella? You recognize that guy?
Yeah, I need a haircut now, but not as much as Dan.
Oh my goodness! So this is, I guess, a publicity photo from the Sports Information Department at UVA. What year would this have been?
This would have been 72,
73.
Wow!
Now, so did you tell him you wanted to make it just like an in-game scenario where you're running for your life the whole time?
Yeah, with a lot of mud all over me.
Yeah, 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 right.
And here's another, and there's your headshot there.
No, there's another example. Thanks, Tim. Now I don't think I'd need a haircut as shearing as much as I did then.
Oh, yeah. No, you look high and tight now compared to this guy. This is early 70s, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, see, in those days, they'd make you get brush cuts, skin cuts, we'd call them, at when you get into the 2 and 3 a days in the summer. So growing your hair out was your sign of independence or rebelliousness.
Mm. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it was, you could grow your hair as long as you could, but at the beginning of the season, they'd make you get short haircuts. Plus, my parents always, my mother would get out the shears and shear me.
Not like, you know, not like that too much. That's really funny. So these are pictures of you from back in your playing days at UVA when you were the quarterback. And I want to ask you about the quarterback play. I agree with you about Patrick Mahomes. He's just wildly talented. And I think he's in this middle of this stretch now where of just such excellence. Just repeated trips to the Super Bowl, repeated victories in the Super Bowl. I mean, really just unmatched. Really the only one ahead of him, in my view, is got to be Tom Brady. But Brock Purdy is another one who he catches a lot of grief. You know, not a lot of people want to give Brock Purdy credit for being as good a quarterback as he is. And people call him a game manager, which is like the most insulting thing you could say. He's a guy who's out there just not making
mistakes. The worst thing to say is he's a loser.
And that's worse. Yeah, that's worse. Right. That's true. So, but what do you think? Like, I've seen in Purdy, if you blitz him, if you put pressure on Purdy and make him make quick decisions, you can make him make mistakes.
Correct.
But what do you see from him? And in the quarterback matchup, Mahomes clearly has the edge. But what do you see from Purdy? What is he capable?
Well, Purdy. Well, any quarterback. I don't care. Tom Brady, when he'd get knocked down,
yeah,
you know, it's almost like, oh my goodness, it's undignified to have him get grass stains on his pants. They also had such a great offensive line. But any quarterback, if you got folks in your face, you're going to have to make decisions quicker. You're going to have to get rid of the ball. The great thing that Mahomes does is he's got that maneuverability. He played baseball. He throws the ball from all sorts of different angles. Other quarterbacks now are trying to follow him. When I grew up, I've tried to follow Archie Manning. He was my hero, and he was a mobile quarterback, even played with a broken arm in the Liberty Bowl against Virginia Tech. But Purdy is more a traditional quarterback, but he doesn't make many mistakes. He benefits from having a good running game. Any quarterback benefits from a good running game. And McCaffrey is just such a great athlete. He's great running. He's great catching the ball. And they have other players. They have good receivers. They have a good tight end. Both teams have good tight ends. Kelsey's probably a little better than Kittle. But the quarterbacks aren't going to be playing against each other. The quarterbacks are playing against opposition defense. And I think it's really for someone like Purdy, the more they can, and if they can blitz, if they can put pressure on him without blitzing, in other words, having their four down linemen getting pressure on them, that's great. If they end up having to blitz and throw in, you know, a linebacker or two, that means somebody's going to be open. And they have very good receivers with the 49ers. So, the key, generally speaking, the quarterbacks are the most important position. The next most important position is the offensive line and the defensive line. And that's where it's won, because with the way the rules are in the NFL or even college these days, the only way you can really have an impact on the passing game is pressuring the quarterback. And so that there'll be a premium on that. And so if the 49ers can protect Purdy and they can run the ball, they'll probably win the game. If they can't, the Chiefs will. But I mean, that's what I said at the beginning, the team that can run the ball and stop the run, if a team can do both of those, my view is they'll win.
At that level, do adjustments matter that much in the locker room? Like, can you go in and say, all right, we schemed a couple things here in the first half, didn't work out, but I'll tell you what I saw. Let's try and put pressure here or drop people in coverage, et cetera, et cetera. I know it matters, but how much do you think that matters in like a Super Bowl?
I think it matters a great deal. You'll see what's working. A lot of teams, including the 49ers, they'll script their first 14, 15, 16 plays. And from that, you adjust from, all right, this you know, say our right tackle can beat their defensive end. We can run the ball off the right side, or they have it so packed inside, we're going to have to run wide. Or on defense, we're just saying we're not getting enough pressure on them. They're just eating us up because the quarterback's got so much time. We're going to have to take a risk and do some blitzes. If you're playing man, you may want to do a modified man and zone or pure zone. So and you want to hide it. And so there's a lot of adjustments made during the game and a lot made at halftime. And generally speaking, at halftime, you know, the team that first series on offense and first series on defense really sets the tone for the whole second half. And those are adjustments that are made. Now the intensity needs to be there. Performance needs to be there. You know, the team that makes the fewest mistakes wins usually as well. That's a whole turnover battle. And then you can have special teams matter. I mean, this could be a game that it probably will be so close that the kicking game will matter. Special teams and the field goal kickers, and the Chiefs have a clearly better, in my view, statistically a better place kicker than the 49ers.
Yeah, you're so right about turnovers, man. Last year's Super Bowl when the Eagles were in there and Jalen Hurts, who otherwise played really almost a flawless game, had a fumble that probably cost him the game. And So the rest of all of his excellence was overshadowed by that one fumble. I think we want to try to pivot a little bit and talk about some politics and stuff. President Biden, coming up, you know, we're about 3 years into his term now. And I think the three of us here can, I think, safely agree that it's been disastrous on a variety of levels, policy-wise, and the results of those policies. We have the border is blowing up. He has completely gutted American energy independence. The economy and inflation and the way that it affects regular people, the attacks on freedom, the constraints on speech and all sorts of different things. Looking at the Biden administration as a whole, What are the things that aggravate you the most? What do you think?
We don't have enough time, so I'll just pick the top ones. It's been a disappointment. I knew Senator Joe Biden when I served in the Senate, and he's governed far left. It's as if Bernie Sanders and the squad has taken over in governance. The border is a major concern. This is a paramount responsibility of the federal government's national defense, including our sovereignty. And that's where you see such a stark difference of a border that was controlled to one that's just wide open. And this is dangerous for our country. It's dangerous, not just physically, but dangerous with drugs coming in. And, you know, a country needs to be able to secure its borders. And they have just did the exact opposite of the Trump administration, whether it's the Remain in Mexico policy being dropped, this latest bill, which of course failed, at least had some efforts to improve the asylum laws. But there's no trust in this administration. They don't care to enforce the borders. It's catch and release. And if you reward illegal behavior, you'll get more illegal behavior. So that's a disappointment. The energy policies. Our country, Tim and Hogan, we're blessed with the most energy resources of any country in the world, with our coal, our oil, our natural gas. And their policies play right in the hands of OPEC and to Russia and to China, that instead of using that affordable and reliable energy from the United States, they think we're going to run our economy on windmills. I mean, the only thing more stupid than onshore wind is offshore wind. And they're doing this off the coast of Virginia. They work 3 out of 7 days. They work about 40% of the time, which is 3 out of 7 days of the week. Would you buy a car that if they said, "Hey, there's a brand new car here, new technology, and the manufacturer says it'll work 3 out of 7 days of the week," and you might not be driving those days it's not working? Would you buy such a car? No, but that's what they're doing, and they're distorting the free market. And we're not getting affordable, reliable energy. And it's so regressive because the people hurt worse by having to pay for higher fuel costs, higher electricity costs, higher food costs are not these wealthy elites who can fly to some UN climate conference in Cancun or some France or somewhere. It is hardworking, lower and middle income families who are hurt the worst. That's why I refuse to call them progressive. They're regressive because they're hurting working families the most. And by increasing the cost of electricity and fuel, that makes our manufacturing and our production and our cost of living in the United States much more costly than it needs to be if we unleashed our plentiful American energy resources. And so they're just ridiculous. And it's not just ridiculous. It is so harmful and damaging to the American people, our competitiveness, our security. Now they've stopped any new permitting of liquefied natural gas. Well, we're trying to get Europe not to be captive customers of Russia for natural gas. Well, I think it's great that we're helping out our European friends with natural gas from the United States. If they don't get it from us, they'll get it from Qatar or they'll get it from Australia. But it's for jobs in our country, our balance of trade, national security, and not just ours, but again, for our allies. It makes absolutely no sense to shut down production in our country. And the Biden administration's part of this religion, this climate cult apocalypse crew. And they think by increasing prices on everyone, this is going to somehow affect the weather. And it's ridiculously harmful and dangerous. And I think By the way, Tim, I know you're from Pennsylvania. The folks in Pennsylvania are not maybe Philadelphia, but the rest of the state is energy literate. And that's why President Trump won Pennsylvania in 2016. And I think people see that. And so in any energy producing state or places where people are energy literate, I think that they're gonna reject these harmful anti-American energy policies with this blissful, whimsical nonsense of thinking we're going to run our economy on intermittent, costly sources of power. I'm not against solar. Solar can be supplemental, and you can have rooftop solar, put solar panels in the airports where, you know, there's no cattle grazing on that grass or anything else, or rooftops, parking lots, all that. That's fine. And that you might could get, you know, some percentage from it, and battery technology will get better. But you're not going to run an economy that cannot have, especially businesses, that can have no sags, no surges, no blips, no interruptions on costly electricity. So this just got to get back to reality and think what's best for the people rather than these whimsical climate hysteria approaches.
Well, that's a great point. You can't run this. You can't run our country on gumdrops and unicorn hair. You need coal, you need natural gas, and they just act like these things fall out of the sky. But I have to ask you, because yes, you were a governor, and we're calling you that because you were, and we like that office way better than Senate, as outlined very astutely in this podcast. But you were a senator, and there's something going on in the Senate now that I think we could really use your insight and your guidance on. So a couple of points. This interesting thing with Senator Lankford putting forth this energy bill, or excuse me, the border bill that, as you point out, really didn't do anything to close the border. How is that done in the Senate, where McConnell kind of gives it over to somebody like that? And then how does that kind of mature into what we end up seeing with the bill coming forward? But also, in a million years, do you think you would have seen McConnell give that bill to somebody? And then as quick as the person he tasked with putting it forward, he backtracks on it and kind of leaves poor Lankford out there on a limb? That seems a little weird. So I'm going to ask you about that situation. And then second is, a lot of people on the right now are saying that McConnell's in serious trouble. Cruz and others are looking for a power change dynamic, I guess, in the Senate. So get your thoughts on both of those topics.
Okay. I generally speaking, and Tim knows this, I like to talk about ideas and issues, not process and personalities or partisanship.
Sure.
The way it works, there's times where you let a senator take the lead on certain issues. I came into the Senate and they saw what I had done as governor in Virginia in technology. When I came in as governor, the number one manufactured export from Virginia were cigarettes. Marlboros are made in Virginia.
Right, right.
When I left office, semiconductor chips were the number one export. So they had me head up the high tech task force that then it was Trent Lott and then mm-hmm. Bill Frist and then McConnell. But they said, all right, you take the lead on these issues, on keeping taxes off the internet, and was the lead on the nanotechnology initiative. So a leader will deploy a senator who has a propensity, an interest, a conversance on an issue to take the lead. And so Lankford, who's a conservative from Oklahoma, I mean, if the whole country voted the way Oklahoma did,
we'd be better off. Sure.
You're just great. And so they took the lead. And so, but he had to negotiate with the mm-hmm. other side. And maybe this was the best he could do, dealing with Schumer and the way the Democrats and the Biden White House is. I think as a leader, McConnell saw this is getting nowhere. It wasn't going to get the support from the members. They weren't going to get the 60 vote supermajority to go with it. And there were just so many problems with it because, number one, you don't trust the Biden administration. Then they had this provision in there that even if everything else was pretty good in it, and there were some things that were better than nothing, especially on the asylum criteria, but it's still going to be catch and release. We know the way they operate. It doesn't matter what the law is. They have laws that they could be using now, but they had a provision, and this is the lawyer in me, that said that if there's a dispute, there's no lawsuits by the states and state courts. You have to sue in the DC court.
Yeah, crazy.
Liberal, if nothing else, just that. And that's just a lawyer in me that, all right, you are rigging the system because there are going to be lawsuits because they're going to be having all sorts of writs of mandamus trying to get the Biden administration to enforce. They don't even enforce the current laws, much less a new law. And this is just window dressing. But to allow that in itself was just such an abdication to the elites in Washington and the worst court in the, well, maybe there's Manhattan court might be worse, but you know, Southern District of New York or the Ninth Circuit, which is awful as well. But the point is that just takes away any recourse from those who think the way us and others think that we ought to be protecting and securing our borders rather than this catch and release scheme. So I think what the leader McConnell thought was all right, this is going down. Why keep beating a horse that's
right,
dead?
Right.
With it, as far as leadership, they'll after the elections this year, they'll select leaders and we'll see where that.
Where it goes.
I do think there'll be a Republican majority. I think we'll definitely pick up West Virginia. I think we have a great chance of winning in Ohio.
Hmm.
And with the right candidate, I think we could win in Montana as well. Now, there's times we thought we were going to win Georgia and Pennsylvania and Arizona and New Hampshire and all this last time, and the Republicans clearly underperformed in those races. So. But I think West Virginia, Ohio are the two best opportunities. I don't see any Republican being in danger losing a seat. So we'll pick up the Senate, and the key will be in the House will be close again. And obviously you get the presidential election, and that's going to come down to Georgia and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Arizona, Michigan, Nevada.
It's going to be tight again. It's going to be, you know, tens of thousands of votes total spread across three or four states. That's going to decide the presidential election for sure. Just like the last two.
Yeah. But the thing is Biden is going into this as low approval ratings, lower than even Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of, there's a lot of people, 70% supposedly would wish it were another choice. But elections are about choices. And you think back to Ronald Reagan asking, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if you ask people that on the border issue, that to me, that which is right now the number one concern of most Americans, understandably. Heck, it's not just Republicans. It's a city, New York City mayor, a Democrat, the Chicago mayor, a Democrat, the Democrat governor of Arizona, who's upset with this lawlessness and what's going on. Then you get 60 Minutes running that show on all the Chinese. These are not just people from Mexico and Central America. They're people coming in from every continent in the world and all these from China. And so when I was watching that 60 Minutes, I said, all right, it may be that conservatives don't watch that and liberals or Democrats don't watch Fox News or News Nation or whatever. I said, they're watching this. And this, if 60 Minutes is making a big deal about this, they cannot ignore it. And it's, but then you have California foolishly giving free health care, to people. I was just thinking, all right, so they already have the high, and they have a big budget deficit, and they have the highest income tax and the highest sales taxes in the country. They are losing population. Them and New Jersey, New York, Illinois are losing population. And so they're going to have to raise taxes some more. I said, great. This just means more are going to move to Arizona and Nevada and Tennessee and Texas and Utah and Idaho and other states. And it's they don't get it. And the reality is in our country, we have freedom of movement. And I always like to read this Chief Executive Magazine polling. It comes out in April of the best and worst states for business. Year after year, consistently, the top three states for best states for business. Number one is Texas. They've been number one for 19 straight years. Florida, number two. Tennessee, number three. North Carolina's number four. Arizona, five. The common ground of Texas, Florida, and Tennessee is they have zero state income tax in those states. And the states are the worst states for business, you can guess. New York, California, New Jersey, Illinois. Yeah. And people are moving. And the pandemic and the restrictions on free people and their livelihoods and the government mandates only accelerated that exodus of people from these high tax, high cost, restrictive states to states where you get more bang for the buck and you get more freedom rather than these nanny laws. And the prime nanny law that I love to bring up in every speech is I ask the audience or the crowd, who do you think ought to decide what kind of car you want to drive? And I say, whether you want a battery, hybrid, gasoline, diesel, corn from a jar, it doesn't matter. We, the people, should decide, not these elitists.
Yeah.
They want to ban gas stoves and they want to ban the internal combustion engine. And it's really rare to have someone say, oh, I would really like these people in Washington to tell us what kind of car we ought to drive.
Yeah. Who is that person? I'd love to meet
him. Yeah. What else could you tell them to do?
Well, Governor, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. And
absolutely.
Great insight. To me, this is like a walk down memory lane and hearing you talk so passionately again about all of the different principles and all of your firm beliefs and the way that you governed the Commonwealth of Virginia and operated in the Senate and how you still believe the country should operate. It's refreshing, I guess, based on what we see in Washington now. But I mean, you were so right. And I love what Governor Youngkin is doing in Virginia. Yep. But for me, you will always be, you are my governor of Virginia for now and for all time. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Governor. Appreciate it.
Great conversation.
Good to be with you, Hogan. Great always to be with you, Tim. And I'm so glad we do have Governor Youngkin who has liberated Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And please say hello to Susan, Mrs. Allen, and your kids. It's been a long time. Tyler, Forrest, and Brooke. I remember when you had them sledding down the hill at the Capitol when you were governor. That's how 30, I'm sure you know this. It's been 30 years since you were inaugurated.
Heck, Brooke wasn't even born then. But come visit us in Virginia Beach. We'd love to have you.
I will do that. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. This has been the Line Drive Podcast.